Hello!
Hey guys, it's Arden Cho.
Hey, I'm Holland Roden.
Hello, this is Ian Bowen.
Hey you guys, this is Melissa Poncio.
Hi, I'm Lyndon Ashby.
Hi, I'm Dylan Sprayberry.
This is Megan Tandy.
This is Tyler Posey, and you are listening to Not Another.
Not Another.
Not Another.
This is Not Another Teen Wolf Podcast.
Yes, it is!
Oh.
Woo!
Hey, this is Jeff Davis. You're listening to Not Another Teen Wolf Podcast, my favorite podcast in the world.
But the years have been long, and you have taught me well to hide away. The things that I believed in, you've taught me to call them all escapes. I know who you are. I know who you are. I know who you are now.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Not Another Teen Wolf podcast. This is episode 119 of our show, recapping season 5 of Teen Wolf. So this week was episode 14 of season 5 called The Sword and the Spirit. And we will be talking about that now. So if you've got anything to say to us about that or about the past episodes or what you think is going to happen in future or something completely unrelated altogether, you can reach out and talk to us at any time on our Twitter, which is NATW Podcast. You can email us on our email, which is natwpodcast@gmail.com. You can join us on Tumblr, which is notanotherteenwolfpodcast.tumblr.com. Or if you want to see some pictures of our occasional antics, you can follow us on Instagram, natwpodcast, over at Instagram as well. I am one of your co-hosts, Natalie, and I just make a lot of noise. My other co-host, Karen, is our lead writer for Teen Wolf on the parent website of this podcast, hyperball.com. Hello, Karen.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
How did you feel that I did that intro today?
It was good.
Yeah?
Why?
I don't know. I always feel stupid doing it, that's all.
No. I like your introductions.
All right, well, here we are. The Sword and the Spirit. I did not know what this episode was called until I opened this doc. Can I just say that? Usually, this is the first time I've never known what an episode was called, ever, I think, though. So, I don't know, maybe it didn't circulate very much.
Yeah, I feel like we're getting the titles of the episodes kind of late this year. Usually we have most of them laid out, except maybe the finale, because sometimes the finale name is sort of a spoiler and they like to keep it secret. Mm. But this time it's like we have 5:15, but we don't even have 5:16 yet, and that's a two-part episode.
What's 5:15?
Amplification.
Okay, yeah.
Which seems appropriate, considering. Yeah, it's going to be centered around Lydia, so.
Oh, Karen, my stomach muscles, they actually physically feel weird to touch. It's not going well. Sorry, everyone, I had a gym accident that I was telling Karen about before we started. Anyway, back to Teen Wolf.
Is it an accident if you did it on purpose?
Well, I didn't expect this result, so yes. I don't know. So amplification, that makes sense. And then, yeah, I don't know what will happen after that. So we'll see. Okay, so amplification's on the 2nd of Feb. That's 5:15. And then 5:16 is on the 9th of Feb. And then 5:17 is... we don't know. And then 5:18 is the 23rd of Feb, and that's the flashback. That's the Maid of Jevedon one. Is that right?
Yes. Yep.
Interesting. Cool. Good times. All right. So that's where we're at, and we don't know the ones in the middle there. Well, we do know this one, the sword and the spirit, and that becomes clear later in the episode about what that's about. But before we start, favorite quotes of this episode. Mine was my new fave, Deputy Strauss, who, when he comes into the school, you know, as part of the police crew, this is a nice little bit of world building. I actually enjoyed this for more than just, this is funny. It was a nice little bit of world building because this is a cop we've never seen before, but he comes and talks to Stiles and Stiles talks back to him like they know each other very well, which I'm sure they do because I think Stiles knows everyone in the police station very well. His father's the sheriff. So I really like that kind of like assumed familiarity. And then he's kind of like, you know, they're kind of being like, what's going on here? And he's like, I shouldn't even be talking to you guys, but we don't even know why we've been told to do this. But he's like, I've got a theory. And he kind of leans in and he says, do you guys believe in the supernatural? And both Scott and Stiles are just like their faces are just like, how do we even deal with this? But I really love it because I'm curious about how many people in Beacon Hills think like this, if you know what I mean. Like how many people there are in the town who are like, I think something's going on in our town. Like what exactly is the deal here? I want to know. And, you know, this is an example of that. And so I find that really funny, but also interesting because, you know, people would have to start to suspect, you know, dude, it's Beacon Hills, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. And I think the first people to put it together is going to be the cops because they're involved with everything.
Yeah.
And I mean, we have seen Strauss before.
Oh, yeah.
He's been in a couple of episodes. He was the one that kind of scoffed at Deputy Clark when she was filling out her report about the beast. And so I think it makes sense that he's kind of like, okay, wait, maybe something weird is going on.
Okay, well, fine. We've seen him before, but we haven't, like, seen him. We haven't been fully introduced to him in a way that's like, yes, he and Stiles know each other enough to have this conversation, if you know what I mean. I just like the idea that he knows all the cops, so, yeah. But, yeah, that was fun for me, but also, yeah, I'm very curious as to what the general, you know, people in Beacon Hills make of these constant situations, basically.
I like that they're not all stupid. Like, people put it together.
Yeah.
It makes sense.
And then for you, you had another really good one.
Yeah, this is between Parrish and Chris after Gerard tries to burn a hole through Parrish's head with a torch. And Parrish just goes, this guy's your father? And Chris is just like, wasn't my choice. And it's so perfect because Chris is 1,000% done with Gerard at this point. But he knows he kind of has to be there. And there are a few other threads throughout the episode that we'll hit on. But this one just really stuck out to me because Chris was like, God, I wish he wasn't. But yes, that is my father.
Chris is like easily my favorite part of this episode, actually. Like, I just loved every second of his like hangdog expression. Like, oh, God, I have to do this. And he's so ashamed when Scott's like, really? He's like, yeah, really. Like, he's just, I loved him so much in this episode, so, yeah.
Yeah, well, and I think that's a good transition into our discussion, because the episode opens with Gerard explaining what the beast is and what he knows about the beast, and we learn an important fact that a simple spear in the hands of a young woman is what killed the beast the first time around, and this is the Maid of Gévaudan, so maybe this is a clue as to who or what could possibly kill the beast this time around. And one of my favorite moments was just Chris holstering his pistol and taking out the big gun and being like, yeah, we need a little bit more firepower here. Mm-hmm. And the look on his face was like, he looks concerned, to say the least.
Yeah, so Gerard has all these stories, like, about the, you know, the history. How come Chris doesn't know about them, like, before now, if you know what I mean? Like, Chris is what, like 50, like 45, you know, some age. Like, why, you know, if he was raised by his father, how come he didn't, like, hear all of these tales, you know, as a child? Like, I mean, this is just nitpicking, but, like, you know, they apparently need Gerard around because he has all of this history. Do you think that he maybe wasn't that forthcoming with it?
could have been, or maybe it was just one of those things that, like, this is a story that Gerard was told as a kid, didn't necessarily grow up believing that it was a possibility, and therefore feeling like it needed to be passed on to his children because, you know, whoever would have thought that the beast would come back? Well, now it has, and I'm sure Chris wishes he knew this information, but I mean, maybe it was just one of those things that it's like, yeah, well, we need to tell the audience somehow, and Gerard has to be involved, so this is just how we're going to do it. But I think we can explain it away, something like that. Gerard just wasn't too concerned about it because he didn't think it'd ever be a problem.
Yeah. And then they face the Dread Doctors, and Gerard's like on top of it. He's like, you know, disabling them by basically putting like a frequency messer. We learn, I don't know what this whole frequency situation is, that, you know, different things operate on a different frequency and you can kind of scramble their ability to function by messing with it. But he does that, and yeah, you know, pity we didn't know about that earlier, because it seems to have actually kind of paused them for a while.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if they were trapped in the spot or if it just made them, like, corporeal or what exactly was going on there. Like, but did it actually...
corporeal? Like, are they...
Well, you know how they, like, fade in and out?
Yeah, but I thought that was just, like, people's perceptions of them fades in and out, that they're real, but people don't see them.
I definitely think they're real, but I always assumed they had the ability to kind of disappear and reappear in a certain way, because they kind of come and go very strangely. They don't necessarily just walk into a room all the time. Sometimes they kind of show up out of nowhere. Because if Gerard could just freeze them in their place, why didn't he just take them out right then and there? You know, they must have still been dangerous somehow.
Yeah, but he's not, like, that helpful. Like, I don't think he really wants them dead. I don't think he really particularly wants to help anyone. Like, you know? who knows?
Yeah.
Aside from that, they're hanging out, you know. Well, not hanging out. They're wandering around trying to find whatever it is they're trying to find or check stuff out. And, yeah, they kind of just freeze the Dread Doctors and off they go, and then they find their pile of 23 bodies in a drain, which is really nice. Basically, Chris lights a flare and sees a big pile of bugs, and then under the big pile of bugs is a big pile of bodies. So that's unpleasant.
Yeah, to say the least. I was really concerned what he was seeing at first. I was like, oh my god, is it a pit of, like, maggots? Is it, like,
I was very not happy about the maggots.
Yeah, not to say that the bugs weren't completely disgusting anyway, but yeah.
Yeah, and so it's a pile of 23 people that the beast apparently has killed. And so it's a big, this is a town crisis. Like, this is not underplayed. This is, you see them in the hospital wheeling, you know, black bagged body after black bagged body into the hospital. All of these found bodies, and there's a whole town curfew, you know, of everyone is being basically guarded by armed cops. You know, there's armed cops at the school, town curfew, all of that kind of stuff, because this is a crisis, basically. You know, don't care if you have supernatural stuff or not, like, someone finding a, you know, a stash of 23 bodies is quite a big deal. So I kind of liked how grim and quiet that was, like, when they started kind of bringing them into the hospital, like, the idea that, you know, this isn't just in the supernatural bubble, that this is a big, big tragedy for the town.
Yeah, and I think that's highlighted when they enact the curfew, when the cops are roaming the halls of the school with giant shotguns. Like, that's terrifying, and that's no joke. And I liked the way that all the kids, not just, like, you know, Scott and his friends, but all of the kids in the hallway were, like, so quiet and reserved, and everyone knew that scary things were happening, and it's good that they took a moment to show that, I think, because it's really important on Teen Wolf in particular to constantly remind us that not everybody knows about the supernatural, and yet everybody's affected by the supernatural. Mm. And it just keeps that world more realistic, which I've always enjoyed.
Yeah, and then obviously there's a little bit of a issue with Parrish in that he is more stricken than anyone. He's kind of just standing there really upset, really horrified, because he thinks that his, like, nightmare of seeing everyone dead, his dream, is coming true. And the sheriff tries to handle him really well. He's like, no, here's what we're going to do. You know, he's like, I know what you're thinking. I know you think this is, like, your dream and this is to do with you. It's not. You're going to do your job. You're going to go and check the missing person's record. This is what we do. This is how we're going to handle it. This is how we're going to help. And he says that to Parrish because it's sort of what Parrish needs. But then he goes straight to Scott and is like, yeah, his dream's coming true.
Yeah.
And that's, like, pretty harsh. Like, that's pretty horrible. And, I mean, they're kind of trying to protect Parrish from himself, I think, because he's really much less in control and of anything that happens to him than a lot of the other supernatural creatures in the show. And I feel bad for that. But, yeah, like it or not, here it is.
Yeah, I do feel bad for Parrish just because, like, you could see how in his own world he was when he was staring at them, probably wondering, you know, did I have a hand in any of this? What am I? What's going on? Mm. Does this mean all my friends are going to die? Does this mean I'm going to die? He's very new to this. Not to say that, like, someone like the sheriff isn't, because the sheriff hasn't known for a super long time and he hasn't always had a direct hand in what's going on. But Parrish at this point still doesn't even know what he is. And I think that's terrifying.
Yeah, I keep forgetting that he doesn't know who he is. So who did know who he was at this point? Like, who knows about the Hellhound situation?
It was only Lydia. Lydia never got the chance to tell anybody about it.
Oh, okay. Okay, so she's...
Because I was wondering that, yeah, too. I was like, wait, doesn't everybody know? But because of what happened in the finale in the first half of the season, Lydia was knocked out, and by the time everything went down, she was already, like, being taken into Eichen and stuff, so she never got a chance to explain it.
Yeah, that's true, actually. Well, it's all going to come into play, you know, later in this episode. But yeah, the poor boy, he's kind of a wreck about it. And then obviously, we highlighted the bit that I talked about in my quote with Strauss saying, you know, do you guys believe in the supernatural, and what that means for the fact that the pieces are starting to come together for everyone. Like, everyone's kind of like, hello, you know, this is happening. Gonna start thinking outside the box here, and I'm wondering how many people that's happening for.
Yeah, I'm also wondering if Strauss is evil, because I don't trust him. I really don't trust him. I don't know what it is, but I felt like this was such a strange moment. It seemed kind of random, and because it seemed random, I'm wondering if it's important.
What do you mean?
Well, it didn't necessarily add to anything. I mean, we saw the guns and stuff, and, you know, this is sort of a cop that we've only seen a couple of times. Why is it important that he said this to Scott and Stiles? Maybe it's because later on it means, you know, more people are going to be realizing what's going on, especially because Parrish is supposed to be the one protecting, like, these places and the supernatural. Maybe he needs to, like, step up his game and make sure that regular people don't come across the supernatural as much. Or maybe Strauss is more than he's letting on. I've seen some people wondering if he could possibly be the beast. Mm-hmm. So for now, I'm keeping him at a distance. I don't trust him.
Okay.
And we'll just see what happens.
I thought it was just more of a gag, but we'll see.
It could have been. I totally could be reading way more into this, but you never know.
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough.
And then one of our absolute faves comes back, Mr. Yukimura.
Yeah.
It's really nice to see him. And his scenes with Kira are always really funny, and this one was no different, but at the basis, it was actually really serious, because He explains that her sword is a gateway to the fox, and the fox is too dangerous. And so he disassembles Kira's sword, which was really cool. I didn't expect him to actually, like, do it that way. I thought he was just going to, like, take it away from her. But he actually breaks it into pieces, and hopefully she can get it back eventually because that sword is really awesome. But he tells her to outfox the fox and to use her mind in order to control the fox. And I think moving forward, that's going to be a big part of Kira's story, especially since she's going to have to find another way to defend herself that doesn't include the sword and also doesn't make it so that the fox takes over and starts killing people.
Yeah, I mean, because he says, you know, you know how to fight, but, you know, without any supernatural powers or a weapon, she's quite a young girl who doesn't have that much to fight with. So I don't know how that's going to go, but we'll see, I suppose. Because they have that conversation, you know, about the... obviously, the sword and the spirit, that's where the title comes from. But, you know, what he says to her, what she says to him, she's like, you're not going to tap me on the forehead and say my mind is a more powerful weapon, are you? You know, like, how's that going to work? Like, when he says you know how to fight, like, what do you think? Do you think he means literal combat, or do you think it's sort of something different to that?
It could be hand-to-hand, which I would actually really like to see from Kira, but... I'm wondering if she's forced to rely on more than just the sword, what that's going to do. Because he does specifically say that the sword is the gateway to the fox. So I think the two are tied together very closely. Maybe without the sword, she'll have a better idea of how to control the fox. She'll have to actually concentrate on doing that with her mind rather than getting out of control with the sword.
Mm. Our other favorite character, Theo, he's here. Aren't you glad?
Totally.
He pulls, you know, a charming and reasonable move in drugging Malia in order to take her to the Dread Doctor's laboratory, lair, because there is some equipment there that can help her locate the Desert Wolf. And apparently Theo's willing to help her access this, but... apparently, you know, he still has enough loyalty or fear for his own safety or whatever to not be able to show Malia where the Dread Doctor's lair is. So he drugs her and takes her there. It's basically the equivalent of, like, when the mob, you know, brings you in to do, like, a business deal, but they don't want you to know where you are, so they put, like, a bag over your head and then they drive you around in circles and then you have to come and do the deal and then they take you away again. I know someone who this has happened to in real life. So, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
You have some interesting friends.
It was actually my osteopath. He was once hired by someone. He was like, that someone called him and was like, we need you to do, like, a private treatment. We need you to come and work on someone, like, work on their back because they're injured and we need you to do that. But we need you to do it at, like, their hotel room, like, we can't come to you, blah, blah. And he's like, oh my God, is this, like, a celebrity or something? Like, he didn't say that, but they were like, we're going to pick you up here. And they put him in, like, a closed van, drove him into, like, the basement of a hotel, don't know what hotel it was, went up in the room, wasn't allowed to see any signage, didn't see the person's face, treated them like they were already face down on a bed, did the treatment, got taken away and got taken out again. So this is basically what happened to Theo, what happened to Malia with Theo, except instead of, you know, Malia being brought in to do an osteopathic treatment on a mobster, she was being brought in to have her eyes stabbed, which was a lot less fun, probably.
Yeah, I'd say so. Although Theo was seeming to have a lot of fun here. They have a lot of chemistry. It makes me very uncomfortable.
Yeah, I'm just going to keep making that noise until it stops, basically. Can they not, like, though? Like, please don't. I don't want them to have hate sex. I don't want them to do anything. Like, this will just be very wrong if it does happen.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know. I don't like it either, but it's definitely there.
It needs to not. They need to stop. I'd like them to stop now. How about that? I've asked politely. Next time I won't be so polite. Anyway, so, yeah, they're all sexy times. Step closer. Especially on Theo's part. He's, like, into it. Like, I think he's trying to get with anything he can, honestly. And then Malia puts on the torture goggles that basically stab her around the eyes, apparently. And apparently what they do is that these goggles can, like, it's like a radio, kind of. Like, it's like they tune into a frequency of a being, a supernatural being, and then you're able to track them and see where they are at any current moment, like basically picking up a signal, which I don't really understand the science of that well, except for somewhat like a radio, but I don't know if people have frequencies in real life, if that's a thing that actually happened, like if we all have, if we're talking about like, I know that there's electric currents in everything, so I don't know if it's, like, to do with that, but I don't really get that. Point is, Malia is able to tap into her mother in basically thinking of the memories of her mother shooting up her car and stuff like that, and she's able to see sort of flash in and out of visions of her mother in the current moment, and it turns out that she's in a fort that's actually in Beacon Hills in an abandoned army base, so she's actually made it all the way back to Beacon Hills, and then Malia wants to go after her.
Yeah. I really like two things about this whole scene. One was Shelley Hennig did an incredible job pretending that she was getting stabbed in the eyes. And I thought that was just really powerful, and her screams were so guttural. And I don't know, it really kept me in the scene. The other thing that I really liked was that this is all, you know, still science-based, because the cool thing about Teen Wolf is, like, yeah, it does deal with the supernatural, but it's all very realistic, and they try to insert science as much as possible, and I think this is definitely, like, getting close to the line where it feels a bit more mystical, which is cool, because we still have those kind of elements with, like, the druids and everything they deal with, but the fact they can keep it kind of like this steampunk scientific blend of the supernatural and science, which is exactly what the Dread Doctors are, was really cool, and yet it allowed us to get information that we didn't have before in a really different kind of way, and I don't know, I really enjoyed it.
Well, turns out that she's still working with Brayden, which is fun.
Yes.
They're still hanging out and, you know, shooting things together and stuff like that. So that's fun.
Yes.
But Brayden is less than cool with Theo's involvement in their little plan.
Yeah, Brayden is really not into it, and she should really listen to her gut.
Like,
and
don't
so
blame
should Malia.
Her.
Yeah. But she doesn't want Theo to come along, and yet Theo is like, you know, he won't stop Malia from killing the desert wolf, at least that's Malia's reasoning, and he wants to actually help them. Brayden's
why?
Not too happy about it.
Do we know in any way why he is participating?
I think, well, I mean, the reason why he's really participating is that he needs to lead them there so he can double-cross them. I think the reason why he tells Malia he wants to help is because he doesn't want the desert wolf to be around either. Like, he wants to put her in the ground so it's something that he doesn't have to worry about. So he does a really good job, I think, of kind of, like, he definitely wants both things. Like, he doesn't really want the desert wolf around, but he also kind of needs her around. And so he's going with the path that's going to get him what he wants the most, and that just so happens that he's going to align with the desert wolf right now. Unfortunate, but that's kind of how Theo plays the game. What I was more interested in was what Brayden had to say, which is that the desert wolf isn't as fast or as strong as she used to be, but she's still a perfect shot, so she's super dangerous.
But her supernatural powers have diminished.
Right. And we'll talk about maybe why later on when Malia goes up against her, but
and I mean, it's something that we kind of first see when Malia's wearing the goggles and Deaton's being like, no, it has to be a full moon, I told you, and, mm-hmm. you know, in order to... I've got some questions about Deaton, again, as always. I've got some questions about Deaton's motives, but, yeah, carrying on, and we'll get to that in a little bit. Yeah, so Desert Wolf, very dangerous lady, but not so strong in the were-coyote world, basically. Strong for a person and a killer, but not necessarily strong for a were-coyote. So that's interesting. Earlier in the episode, Malia tells Liam to basically go and give Scott some information that she found out, you know, basically that, yes, the Dread Doctor's lair is near those tunnels. Liam's kind of like, why can't you tell him? And she's like, I can't talk to him right now. And Liam's like, well, I can't talk to him right now either. So instead of going to actually tell Scott what's going on, Liam decides to go and take himself to see if he can figure the thing out by himself. Which is very stupid, but good for him.
Very stupid, but very brave. I mean, you have to give him a little credit.
Stupid. It's just stupid, Karen. yeah. Turns out that, you know, it's okay, though, because his dad was following him and watching him basically from the shadows and just trying to let him make his own mistakes until he made his own mistakes 5 times in a row, in which point Scott... was like, hello, I'm here. You are kind of failing.
Please tell me when you saw this scene that you thought of Derek and Scott.
I didn't actually. No, I mean, really? I can see it, but I didn't. I can see that, but I didn't necessarily think about that
association. Yeah, it just reminded me of when Derek followed him all day, and I just, I have like my face.
How long have you been following me all day? Duh, like.
I had my face in my hands because I was like, oh my god, Scott McCall is pulling a Derek Hill right now, and it's kind of beautiful.
Derek is so much more like of a... Derek following Scott is not a protective thing. Derek following Scott is like a nerdy, dumb baby thing. Like, if Liam had been following Scott around secretly, I would have said it. But Scott... Derek could never be like Scott, I don't think. Like, we know this, but Derek's actions will always be 5,000 times more ridiculous than Scott's could ever be. So, I didn't really make the connection, but I do see what you mean. Scott was, you know, being very kind and patient and basically kind of tracking Liam and helping him. Well, not helping him, but kind of looking after him. And then they kind of have their little conversation in which they make up, which is nice. Later on, they kind of talk about why Liam hasn't apologized, and that was actually really, really brilliant. But at this point, it's just Scott's been following him around. Liam's missed his turning 5 times, and Scott's watched it happen 5 times. And by time number 6, he's just like, nah, can't do this anymore. Hi, Liam, I'm here. like, how many times is this kid gonna do this? And it's very sweet, but yeah.
Yeah, it is. And I do really like their conversation too, which we'll get to in a minute. But that was sort of broken up with a couple of other actually pretty important scenes. One of them is Meredith is still teaching Lydia how to use her voice. And we don't actually know much about Meredith and how she learned to be the Banshee that she is now. Mm-hmm. But she does give us a little backstory to using her voice and how it can really hurt people. And she explains to Lydia that her voice is like a bomb and Lydia's voice needs to be like a bullet. Mm. And I think this is so important in the way that Lydia is going to be using her voice and potentially, you know, maybe that is how she's going to end up taking down the Beast. If she's the one to take down the Beast, we don't know yet, obviously, but I kind of saw the connection there between, okay, this girl with a simple spear defeated the Beast way back when. Maybe somebody like Lydia, who has the ability to make their voice into something like a bullet, could end up defeating the Beast too. I mean, I don't know if you can really liken those things, but I sort of saw it.
Yeah, I was sort of just more thinking about Meredith's situation versus Lydia and kind of what it means to have you know, I guess have help or have training, because, yeah, you know, the whole way through Lydia's kind of being like, why won't you tell me? Like, maybe your way would work for me. Maybe your way would work for me. I can't do it myself. And Meredith's really insistent that, you know, Lydia has got to be more controlled and better, basically, than she is. And it sounds like Meredith really never learnt to actually train her own voice. Like, and again, it's why I'm wondering if her real body, where her real body is and what it can actually do, because, you know, when she says, my voice is like a bomb going off, not was in that one occasion, like, she seems to think that it's always like that, whereas she's trying to, like, train mm-hmm. Lydia early so that she doesn't have the same mistakes, basically.
Right, and I really liked how she was like, you need to find your own way. And I think that wasn't just because Meredith's way can be so dangerous, but I think it's important for just Lydia to find herself in her powers. And she kind of ends up doing that because really for the first time, I think, we see her seeing a premonition that is very clear and lengthy, and that she sees the desert wolf attacking Malia. And this sort of goes on at the same time. It's spread throughout the episode, but those scenes are parallel. And just having her be able to see Malia in that way and fighting so hard to get to her, I love it so much.
Mm. Yeah, as I've said, yeah, many times before, it has taken a very long time for Lydia to have any semblance of control over what she can do, so it's kind of interesting to see what she might actually have the capability to do, you know, when she is controlling it, I suppose. Sort of meanwhile, her real body is visited by Styles, which is very nice, kind of very sweet and quiet, and he's very, you know, always very concerned about her, and so he's come in to see her, and her mum, you know, her mother kicks him out, basically, because she, you know, hates them all, and she's like, you need to leave now, or you don't get to come again, and yeah, she's having a bit of a high horse time at the moment, but as he's leaving, he notices that she's got shaved spots on her head, and her mother says it's for electric convulsive therapy, but Styles thinks he knows it's not and thinks that they're gonna drill a hole in her head, which from the flashback we kind of know they do, if you know what I mean. Like, if we're going back to the start of 501, you know, we know that they do. And so that's going to be interesting when that happens, whether that actually proves to be a good thing or not. You know, like, if Valak does that to her, if she's going to come out of that being like, oh my god, they tortured me, they drilled a hole in my head, or if she's going to be like, no, this is actually, like, a good thing. You know, this is a tool that I have, like, this is a channel to, you know, if it actually does the things he wanted it to do, and if it helps her, because there were definitely tribes and stuff like that that did this kind of trepanation on purpose, you know, and Valak did it to himself on purpose in order to have more knowledge, to have, like, more connection to the spirit world or whatever it was. So certainly something you wouldn't want someone to do to you without your consent. But I'm wondering if this will actually end up being a bad thing for Lydia or a good thing, if you know what I mean.
It sounds like he's trying to amplify her powers. Mm. So I definitely think this is a good thing. I mean, it sucks to have your head drilled, but he does explain when we see him the couple of times when there's a flash forward, I guess you could call it. It's present day, and the rest of the series right now is a flashback, but
yes,
it gets hard to, like, remember that when you're spending so much time in the past. But when we do see Lydia in the present day, Valak is definitely trying to help her. So I think in the end, it is going to be a good thing.
Yeah, and then it's basically the scene where the very mean female orderly comes to take her to the showers, and it's the same as the, you know, 501 where they're like, I know you're faking and all of that stuff. So we're up to that point, and just after that, you know, Styles, you know, basically gets kicked out. You know, the mother demands that he leaves, and she basically says, yeah, like, go or you're not coming back, like kind of holding that over his head, and he looks very upset and hateful.
Yeah, it's not even hateful, really. He's so hurt that she would do that to him. Mm. And I understand that she blames him, even if I don't agree with her. But even so, like, it doesn't take a genius to figure out how much Styles cares about Lydia.
Mm.
And to do that to a child, essentially, you know, is cruel. And I'm losing a lot of sympathy for her, and I don't want to. And I'm hoping, given what we've seen in previews for next week, maybe we'll learn a little bit more about why she's acting this way.
Yeah. I'm really, really not sure. But on the way out, you know, Styles manages to bump into someone and swipe some sort of pass, like an entry card or something like that. So clearly he's trying to get her, you know, he's already formulating a plan to either get back in to see her on his own or just to get, you know, to break in general to get her out. So, you know, he's very resourceful at all times, is Styles.
Yes. Yep. He definitely knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
Now we get to what is essentially, I think, the crux of the episode, because this is very important for two reasons. First of which, we get Liam and Scott talking, which hasn't really happened a whole lot, so it's really nice to get this now. And Scott's basically like, you haven't apologized. And I really liked that he pointed that out, because really that's all Scott needs. He needs to know that Liam feels sorry about what he did. But Liam is also like, I can't apologize. Like, he tells that story about apologizing to the person that he beat up and not meaning it. And I think if he apologized to Scott, he would mean it, but it wouldn't be enough because
he doesn't put value in the words.
Right, and yeah. I like that about him. I like that he feels that he needs to prove through his actions that he feels sorry. And he says, you know, I feel like I have to save your life or something. And Scott's like, yeah, well, you're probably going to get that chance. Is this foreshadowing, or is it just a joke because they're always in mortal peril?
Probably that, yeah.
Or both. It could be both.
Yeah.
But they do find the Ouroboros symbol, and Scott's quick to figure it out, and they turn it, and it opens a door, and there's Chris, and there's Gerard, and Scott now knows that he's all better, and yeah, he looks very disappointed in Chris, and Chris looks very ashamed, which was great. And then Gerard, just being his creepy old self, says, when Scott's eyes light up red, I haven't seen that color on you. It suits you. And I'm like, you're probably trying to figure out every single way you can take advantage of the fact that Scott's an alpha now.
Yeah, do you think he, like, means that? You know, like, it suits you? Or do you think that he's, like, you know, do you think that he has any respect for Scott at all?
God, I don't know. I mean, old Gerard, season 2 Gerard would not. Season 2 Gerard would see him as the threat that he could potentially be and want to dispose of him as quickly as possible or use him to his advantage, obviously. This Gerard, while I still think he's evil, has come to realize, I think, that he's not always going to win the battle. And so maybe, you know, choose your enemies wisely kind of thing. So maybe he's like, okay, you know, Scott's an alpha now. I can deal with that. I know that Scott's not terrible like other werewolves are, like, you know, Deucalion or some of the other werewolves that we've met, or even creatures that we've met that have done much worse things. Mm. Hell, his daughter's much worse at this point. But if he actually means it and respects him in that way, I don't know.
Yeah, neither. I don't know. It seemed weirdly genuine, and I'm like, what's your go?
Yeah, well, that's what I'm thinking. Like, he has to have an angle here. He's got to be trying to think of something. But I really love, and they did this with the introduction of Deucalion at the end of last week's episode, saying, like, you know, Theo's looking for a blind werewolf. They kind of slip in this stuff that we know that Scott and the older people know, but the youngins don't know yet.
Yeah.
How Liam's just like, who's the old guy?
Yeah.
They haven't told him about Gerard, which, you know, given everything that's been going on, I can kind of understand that. And some things are just, I think, too painful to talk about. But he has no respect for this guy that Scott's looking at, like, really warily. And I thought that was funny. But then, forgive me, but I thought Gerard was also kind of hilarious when he was like, at the moment, they would call me a necessary evil, but you can call me Gerard. And I was like, oh, God.
I loved Chris the whole time. Like, I loved Chris, you know, Scott just being like, you didn't. And he was like, I had to. Like, he was just so pissed at himself. And, like, Chris certainly has all the respect in the world for Scott. Chris loves Scott, and I like that, like, a lot, you know? Because Chris, I don't know, I think Scott's Chris's alpha as well by this point, you know? I think Scott is the boss of Chris, so that's kind of interesting to me.
Yeah, there's definitely a loyalty there. Whether he's considered part of the pack, who knows, but there's a mutual respect that I think means a lot to both of them. And unfortunately, Chris did have to call back Gerard, but he's proving his usefulness so far. We'll see if he ends up trying to double cross anybody, but Chris and Gerard take the two boys to the fresco, and Chris kind of kicks down the rest of the wall to reveal the dead bodies at the bottom.
Can I just say, this is Chris Argent once again being like, I'm going to save this dramatic move for the right moment, because how did he know what was under there till he kicked it away? Like, how did he do that?
I think he knew there was more of the painting underneath there. Maybe, like, he just hadn't gotten around to looking at it before they came in. I don't know. But there are a bunch of dead people there, and they're kind of like, yeah, this is all of us. And also, you know, they see the hellhound there, and they all kind of together start putting it together that maybe Parrish is the hellhound, which we'll get to in a minute. But, yeah, it was a bit of a dramatic reveal.
Yeah. As was when Scott opened the door and they were right on the other side. Presumably they were both down there just searching for stuff, so yeah. Anyway, Malia and Brayden and Theo track the desert wolf to that Fort Jewett, and basically they're, you know, have some hesitation about going into this abandoned place where the desert wolf is with Deaton. Yeah, they go on in as a, you know, reluctantly united team. But as soon as, you know, the Desert Wolf and Theo are in the same room, Theo double crosses Malia, who's surprised. And,
not Brayden.
And yeah, basically, you know, helps the Desert Wolf and, you know, in a trade for the Rave Wolf's claws for God knows what reason. And yeah, some stuff starts going down pretty badly after that. So this, you know, big fight between everyone there. And yeah, what on earth is going on with Theo here though? Why did he do this? Because he's evil, because he sucks and we hate him. But why, what was he getting out of this? Like, I don't understand, like, why?
Well, the claws, for one.
How important can they be?
Pretty important if Theo's after them.
Yeah, I guess so.
I mean, if you think about it, he wants the beast's power. When we first saw the Rave Wolf, whose real name is Belasco, which I can never remember because we called him the Rave Wolf from the beginning, and now I cannot get that out of my head. He attempted to steal Scott's powers with those claws. So my assumption is that he's going to somehow use the claws to steal the beast's powers.
Yeah, I suppose that makes sense.
Yeah. But before we get there, We get Gerard putting a torch to Parrish's eye to prove that he's the hellhound. Mm-hmm. And I loved when Parrish was just like, what if I wasn't the hellhound? Would you have torched my eye? And Gerard's like, yeah. Like, yes, he's not sorry about it at all. But we do get a little backstory on Parrish here. In Afghanistan, in the army, surviving a bomb blast. And yeah, I mean, we talked about this a little bit, but I definitely assumed everyone knew that Hellhound was, or that Parrish was a Hellhound. And it surprised me when they didn't, but I put it together eventually. And I did actually like the reveal to Parrish himself because, you know, the mirror was right there and he kind of went into Hellhound mode to protect himself and he caught a glimpse of himself and you see him kind of go, oh, crap. This is what I am. And I mean, he knew something was up with him, but he never could put a name to it because Lydia was the only one that had actually figured it out and never ended up being able to tell him. So now he's aware of his own abilities. And I think it's good to have everyone on the same page now.
Yeah. Yeah. Even if it did have to be Gerard that got through, you know, got through to him there, that was annoying. So yeah. I don't know, I did like it. I like his backstory. I like that he's kind of quite intimidated by all of this and quite, I don't know, he feels, yeah, quite nervous and small and stuff like that. So when he was being the IED, you know, technician in Afghanistan, like when he was cutting the bomb and everyone was running away, is that kind of like a self-sacrificial role? Like that, you know, if you, you know, you disarm the bomb and it goes wrong, that you are going to die and that's part of the job?
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Imagine taking that job.
I know.
Yeah. Oh, Parrish, man. Anyway. So, Lydia does actually end up channeling her voice, basically, into her fight scene. And here's what I don't understand. When did Lydia's astral projection go back into her physical body? At what point in the episode?
It was after the shower. She was returned to her bed. And then in her mind, when she, you know, forced herself to wake up, that's kind of when everything happened. Because it was after her shower that the creepy orderly came in and was going to give her something or draw her blood or something and ended up, like, poking her because he is
the worst.
Insane.
Yeah.
Yeah, he is the worst. So sometime after the shower.
Okay. Because I wasn't quite sure about when that is meant to have happened. So, okay, I guess we can take that. And then, yeah, basically she goes out into a fight. You know, she does the fight that we saw in the original episode and, you know, is able to channel her voice into being kind of a projecting power, like shoving people away from her. But she's also got some pretty hardcore fighting moves that seem, you know, pretty crazy and that she's able to bust out, which is fun. You know, we talked about that a lot at the beginning of the season. So how did it feel to kind of see this in context, I guess?
I loved it so much. I think they did such a great job with this because it was nice to finally be caught up with present day. Not that I haven't been enjoying, like, the story up until this point, but I think because this has always been held over our heads, it was like, okay, when are we going to get there? When are we going to get there? And initially, I thought it wasn't going to be until the end of the season until we heard recently, like a couple weeks ago, I think, like the sort of order of the episodes and which episodes were going to focus on which characters, learning that by 15 and 16, we are going to be up to the present. And so this is just great. I'm really glad we're here. And we have a little bit more to do because we still need to get Valak drilling the hole in her head, which will happen in the next episode. But my favorite thing about this was the fact that they interspersed the different scenes together which normally I'm not a huge fan of because basically because it's really hard to recap that way. Whenever I have to do recaps and it keeps jumping back and forth, it's kind of a pain in the butt. But in terms of rewatching a scene that we've already seen and having it be different, still having all of the parts of those scenes, but having different things in between so we get a better idea of what's actually going on both inside Lydia's head and elsewhere in the episode was perfect, because I don't remember exactly which episode it was, but do you remember when Malia was fighting the Dread Doctors? And, oh, it was the one where they had all read the book. And we saw that scene in the beginning of the episode and near the end of the episode. It was the exact same scene over again. And it felt just a little repetitive. Not that I didn't enjoy the scene, but it felt like, okay, we didn't need to see the exact same, like, 5 minutes all over again. This added to what we've already seen, and I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, I agree. Obviously we didn't, you know, we kind of cut back to after she has that vision of Aiden. You know, that doesn't happen here. We just get a bit more of them, you know, electrocuting her with the tape in the rain, which is really nice and medically sound of them and stuff. So that was good. But yeah, she is, I mean, I just can't imagine, maybe I'm too soft, but I just can't imagine Valak condoning this kind of stuff, you know?
What do you mean?
The electrocute, like, the orderly's behavior.
Well, is Valak really running the place, though? Or is he, like, hiding?
I thought he'd taken over there. Or is he not there yet? Has he not come into Eiken yet in...
No, he's definitely already escaped.
Yeah, he's escaped, but is he in Eiken as a doctor now? Or is he
I
not?
Think,
is he going to help getting Lydia out?
Because he was hiding out as that other doctor, I just wonder...
So he's not on their side. He's not on the side of the orderlies. He's like,
no.
So he's like not working with them. He's going to sneak in and try and help her.
I think so.
Ah, I like that.
I know you do.
Yeah. Oh, you know, my weaknesses. All right. anyway, let's move on from that, shall we?
Yeah, so we get Malia throughout this whole thing, and we kind of see the pinnacle of her storyline here as well, in that she's shot in the stomach by Theo.
Do you know, can I just say, when this happened, I literally said out loud, what the fuck? Like, I was just like, did he just shoot her in the fucking stomach? Like, did that really just happen? Like, my God.
I actually screamed, because I was like, all right, Malia's not going to die. Like, it's going to be fine. But it was so shocking anyway that I was just like, and now we know that's probably what Will was looking at when he was like, oh, that's terrible.
Yeah.
He was going to be a jerk once again. So, yeah, he's lived up to all expectations, that Theo, which I guess he can be proud of. I don't know. I wouldn't be, but that's just me. But he does shoot Malia in the stomach. And again, like, I loved Shelley in this scene too. She's so good at just being in pain that badly, which I don't think is super easy when you're not actually in pain. So kudos to her. And yet she still gets up and fights her mom, which is so awesome. And we find out that Malia stole her mother's powers from her, I assume, when she was born. Any theories as to why?
Her mother is a crazy woman and can't deal with the fact that... No, I don't think she really did steal it. I think that her mother is just nuts.
Well, no, because we know that she's less powerful.
Well... Maybe it's more to do with Talia. I don't know. Maybe Talia did something. Maybe that just happens to people when they give birth. I don't know. And she just, you know, ain't good at it. Like,
I mean, I definitely think something else is going on here, because obviously, and like we've had some people on Twitter say some stuff to the effect of like, oh, so giving birth is, you know, took her power or whatever, which is not a good message to portray, which I completely disagree with. That's not what the show is saying, because Talia has given birth and she remained just as powerful. So I definitely think something else is going on with Malia's mother, and the reason why she lost her power, it still could have had to have been to do with Malia. That was a terrible sentence. I apologize. But I don't think that it's directly Malia's fault. Like, I definitely think there's something else going on.
I don't know. I felt like that she was passing the buck a bit, you know, like the mother, I mean, the Desert Wolf. But I'm not really sure.
Maybe.
I was more concerned about Deaton keeping being like, you know, because she tries to kill Malia, you know, she's trying to be like, I'm going to kill you to get my powers back, you know, like I'm going to, you know, my strength is going to come back from you if I kill you. And yeah, I really appreciate Deaton being like, no, told you, has to be a full moon. It's not going to work. And I'm like, okay, are you just saying this to save Malia right in this one instant? Or are you like, I mean, I know that he probably is, but also he sucks so badly that, like, you know, I don't know, like, who are you going to believe? Like, he's so terrible that I don't trust him at all, that I don't necessarily, you know, I understand that in this circumstance he may just be being like, you know, he may just be saying the thing that will keep Malia safe in that very second, but I also would totally buy that he just sucks and, you know, is this a total lie that he's making up, or?
No, I'm not Deaton's biggest fan either. I don't necessarily think he's evil. Now we definitely know he's not the Beast, so that's good. But I definitely think he was saying that to save Malia. Yeah, it's only putting off the inevitable, but it keeps her alive for a little bit longer. So he's trying to do the right thing. Unfortunately, I think that gives a little bit more power to the Desert Wolf, because now she knows when she has to kill Malia. But also, Malia is going to be ready the next time, I think. So it was a bad situation all around, but I think Deaton was being helpful.
Yeah, I guess.
But we find out that her real name is
Corinne.
Corinne. I always say it wrong because I have an aunt Corinne, and so it's spelled very similarly, but yeah. And not that that's, like, you know, a huge piece of information that'll tell us all about her, but people like to know those sort of things. And it is spelled Corrine, which I know some people are having a little trouble with, but Marisol Nichols, who plays the Desert Wolf, said so on Twitter, so it must be true.
Fair enough.
Yeah. And then, of course, the Beast shows up, and Malia saves Deaton. And I really, really, really loved this scene for what happens now, but also what happens later. But in this moment, she's struggling. She's like, do I go save Deaton or do I kill my mom? And she saves Deaton. And the fact that she had been so hellbent on killing her mother, and now she's allowed her to escape in order to save Deaton's life on behalf of Scott, was a really great, subtle character moment for Malia.
Yeah, pity it had to be Deaton, though. Can't let him die.
Maybe it's better because it is Deaton, because he's useless, and yet she knows the value of all human life.
Well, okay, fine. Let's go with that, shall we? I'm sure that that's valid in some way. Look, I don't know. I'll never trust him. For some reason, I really think that he's evil, and I don't know why. I just think that he is, and that he's, like, doesn't really have a moral compass, and that he's just pretending to have one. I don't know. I've got a problem, I know. But anyway, so they have their kind of reunion at the end. But before that, we basically see that the chimeras, you know, while Theo's been hanging out with Malia, he's been sending his chimera pack to go and capture Deucalion. And it takes three of them to bring him in, and they're all pretty injured and beat up. But Deucalion's there, and they've got him. Apparently, the Durak's healing powers on his eyes were only temporary, and that's just the answer to that, basically. And he's very melodramatic, as usual. And apparently, he wants to rip Scott's eyes out because, I mean, I don't know about if he kind of metaphorically wants to take Scott's sight away because he has no sight, or if he literally wants to put Scott's eyeballs into his own face.
Well, he talked about wanting to wear them on his claws.
I think he just kind of meant, like, stab them, you know, until they're dead.
Maybe. Yeah, that's probably it. He was so dramatic. Oh my god, the way that he whipped out his claws. I loved it. I loved every second of it, but he is so dramatic.
Mm.
Yeah, this is interesting to me just for the fact that Scott and Derek let Deucalion go, and they sent him off with a warning, but they sent him off, and they could have killed him right then and there, but that's not who they are. And I think maybe Deucalion is upset that he lost his eyesight again, but it bothers me that he's so hell-bent on going after Scott when Scott is very clearly the good guy, and maybe it's just because Deucalion's evil and that's what he does, but I never really saw him that way because we knew before that he was a very good person and
Deucalion,
he changed. Yeah. And he changed clearly, and I was really hoping that he could move on from that and try to, you know, build himself back up. And the fact that he's back and he wants to kill Scott again, maybe we just don't know enough information yet, but I don't know if I really like it.
Yeah, I don't know why he's so resentful either. Like, you know, is it because he, you know, he got a taste of being healed and then taken away from him and he hates Scott because of that, or what?
Yeah, maybe he just blames Scott. Maybe he thinks that it was like a trick on Scott's behalf or something, but I don't know. Maybe we just don't have enough of his story yet to understand his motivations.
Hmm. Well, we'll see.
Yeah.
Hopefully he gets sick of Theo's shit real fast.
Yeah. End of the episode, though, brings us a pack reunion, almost. We are still missing Lydia, who they do go after, but this was the other really good Malia moment for me, in that Scott recognizes that Malia went after her mother to kill her, and yet didn't end up doing that because she saved Deaton, but also the fact that she went after Deaton because she was feeling guilty about it and didn't want Scott to blame her. And I think there was a lot said between the looks. Mm. A lot said during the looks between those two characters. And it was just, I don't know, it was really nice. And I really liked Malia in this episode.
Yeah, no, I agree. I kind of really liked the way that they, I you know, one of those silent coming together scenes. It was nice, it was sweet, and the understanding was sweet. But yeah, I don't know, Malia, I still don't know if she's, like, a good fit, you know, for this life. Like, if she's ever really going to be, you know, feel in place, or if she'll always keep having these issues forever.
I think she's come a long way from when we first met her. I think she's learning to be this person, because when she was talking about the Dread Doctors and all of the chimeras and all of the people, the teenagers that they were killing, she was really upset about it. She was like, I can't handle another body. And I think she's slowly letting the really wild side of her, that's like life or death, there is literally nothing else, I must survive, she's letting that part go a little bit. I mean, I think it's always going to be a part of her, but now she's seeing the value in friendships and relationships and other people without being like, okay, how can this person help me survive? Mm. And so I think she is getting used to this life.
Well, I hope so. But yeah, just, I don't know. She seems never quite comfortable with, you know, the choices that she has to stick to, basically. But hopefully this one is all good.
Yeah. Jumping into feedback really quickly, because this is something that ties into that. We got a tweet from the Nade 91 who said, Theo said he regrets betraying Malia, which was the only pack member he seemed to like. True or just another trick? I do think this is true. Yeah. I think Theo feels something for Malia, whether he's just intrigued by her or whether he actually feels something in that dark, dark soul of his. Hmm. I don't know, but I think he regrets it. Doesn't mean that he wouldn't do it all over again to get exactly what he wants, but I don't think he took pleasure in hurting her in the way that he's done with other people.
Yeah, I think that he, you know, he had a goal and he was sticking to it, but I do think that, like, alternate, you know, at the same time as that, he also quite likes Malia and maybe wants to, you know, hook up with her or just has some respect for her ruthlessness and all of that. And so, yeah, I think that she probably, you know, that he probably would be like, oh, you know, in another world, I would have quite liked, you know, you, but yeah, I don't know. I think that is probably somewhat true.
Imagine if Theo had found just recently turned Malia before Scott and Co. did. Yeah. She would be his most ruthless ally.
Yeah, that's true. Like, if she'd been the one that he kind of, you know, bonded, if he'd been the one she kind of bonded to in the way that she bonded to,
yes,
Styles, even, that would have been bad. Yeah. That, like, little, you know, loyal, like, you know, teaching her about the world and stuff like that. Yeah, that probably wouldn't have gone very well.
Nope. No. And then do you want to get this next tweet?
Yep. So the second one is from Roni, Veronica Brez, saying Lydia's mum seems kind of suspicious when she was telling Styles to leave. How much and what do you think she knows? I mean, I think that she knows things, some things, you know, I'm not sure how much, like, but I definitely think that she's very angry and upset and has a good idea that, you know, the supernatural has been messing with her daughter, basically. So, I don't know, Karen, how about you?
I definitely think she knows something as well. Previews for next week has the sheriff confronting her about what she possibly knows about what's going on in Eichenhouse, whether that means them not quite treating Lydia correctly or if that means something else, as in, you know, the supernatural floor down in the basement or whatever. But yeah, I don't think she knows as much as, say, like, Deaton would know, but I'm wondering if she, over the years, because her family has been wrapped up in supernatural, given that Lydia's grandmother was a banshee, she's kind of put two and two together, maybe the same way that, like, Harris put two and two together.
Yeah.
Remember Harris, our good pal?
Good old Harris, yeah.
Mr. Harris, chemistry teacher, mm-hmm. Who definitely knew stuff, but maybe didn't know, like, the extent of it or how much it worked. But I'm very curious to find out what she knows is going on, and maybe that's where some of her anger towards Styles stems from, getting Lydia wrapped up in it all.
Yeah, she was possibly, you know, raising her to try and avoid it, like, her, you know, her whole life or something, mm-hmm. like that, you know. It would be like if, you know, I think I've said before, she's a bit like the Dursleys, and it would be like if Harry, you know, started taking, you know, Harry Potter came along and started taking Dudley to Diagon Alley to do wizard shots or something, you know, like, you know, got him on the fire whiskey and she's all mad. But I don't know. Yeah, I think that it's possible that she's one of those people that knows everything about it and has chosen to really reject it and put it aside. I think that that's quite a high likelihood. So that's where I'm at about that, basically. And Brooke also wanted to give a shout out to Malia's bizarre dungarees, which are some of the weirdest pants I've ever seen in my entire life. But
they were so cute.
Yeah, they were kind of cool, so that's good. Yeah, Will should have given a spoiler about that. Like, spoiler, Malia will have some really good shorts.
Yeah. I really appreciate Malia's shorts. Not that everyone else on the show isn't dressed superbly all the time, but Malia's outfits always feel like more accessible, I guess the word is. Maybe it's because I don't wear skirts, and Lydia wears a lot of skirts, and even Kira wears a lot of skirts, but I would much more likely dress like Malia.
Yeah, it's true. All right, well, that's everything that we have for this week. Next week, yeah, we'll be getting more into the Lydia situation, I suppose, and that should be interesting and traumatic, and I'm really excited to see what's going on with Valak, of course, because I've got a one-track mind, but yeah.
The episode's probably going to end on a horrible cliffhanger because this is a two-parter.
That's true. Deucalion, you know, he's an ungrateful jerk, so yeah. That's fun. Poor Liam's going to be so confused by all these old dudes showing up and Scott being like, you know, oh yeah, these guys, and Liam's like, who? And I don't know if many of them, you know, if Kira and Malia have met Deucalion before, and, you know, everyone's, you know, coming together, you know, for the first time, all of these characters that haven't interacted before but that we all know. So, yeah, I still want to know what people know about what the Dread Doctors, what happened when the Dread Doctors were there before. Deucalion, if he lived in Beacon Hills or if he came to Beacon Hills to see Talia, you know, however many years ago when he wasn't evil, he might know. You'd think Deaton would know. Like, he, you know, hasn't he been around long enough? Like, or is that meant to have been like 40 years and he might have been like a child then? I don't know. But something happened. Dread Doctors have come before. Valak remembers it. I'm going to assume Gerard remembers it. So I want to know what's going on with that. Or if that's just something we're never going to see again.
Who knows?
Okay. Well, on that note, we will leave you. And yeah, you guys can let us know what you think is going to happen in next week's episode. And yeah, how many of those horrible orderlies they're going to, you know, be able to inflict some pain on. I'm excited for that. I really want Styles to hit that one with the hipster hair, you know, with a baseball bat. So that'll
be
good.
Oh, my God.
If they haven't, you know, if that isn't included and, you know, someone's listening to this episode, just run out and film that and just splice it in before next week. You can do it. I'm sure that'll work.
We believe in you.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's it for us. So we'll say bye now. And yeah, thanks for listening and enjoy. So bye-bye.
Bye.
You can email us on our email, which is not another teen wolf podcast. No, it's not.